His camp, distinguished by a huge Starbucks coffee promotional banner suspended from a house-sized block of granite, was situated just 5 minutes' walk down the glacier from ours. The sundry men and women who make careers out of scaling the world's highest peaks constitute a small, ingrown club. Fisher and Hall were business rivals, but as prominent members of the high-altitude fraternity, their paths frequently crossed, and on a certain level, they considered themselves friends. Fisher and Hall met in the 1980s in the Russian Pamir, and they subsequently spent considerable time in each other's company in 1989 and 1994 on Everest. They had firm plans to join forces and attempt Manaslu, a difficult 26,781-foot peak in central Nepal, immediately after guiding their respective clients up Everest in 1996. The bond between Fisher and Hall had been cemented back in 1992 when they had bumped into each other on K2, the world's second highest mountain. Hall was attempting the peak with his compañero and business partner, Gary Ball. Fisher was climbing with an elite American climber named Ed Viesters. On their way down from the summit in a howling storm, Fisher, Viesters, and a third American, Charlie Mace, encountered Hall struggling to cope with a barely conscious Ball, who had been stricken with a life-threatening case of altitude sickness and was unable to move under his own power. Fisher, Viesters, and Mace helped drag Ball down the avalanche-swept lower slopes of the mountain through the blizzard, saving his life. A year later, Ball would die of a similar ailment on the slopes of Dolagiri. Fisher, 40, was a strapping, gregarious man with a blonde ponytail and a surfeit of manic energy. As a 14-year-old schoolboy in Basking Ridge, New Jersey, he had chanced upon a television program about mountaineering and was enthralled. The next summer, he traveled to Wyoming and enrolled in an Outward Bound-style wilderness course run by the National Outdoor Leadership School, Knowles. As soon as he graduated from high school, he moved west permanently, found seasonal employment as a Knowles instructor, placed climbing at the center of his cosmos, and never looked back. When Fisher was 18 and working at Knowles, he fell in love with a student in his course named Jean Price. They were married 7 years later, settled in Seattle, and had two children, Andy and Katie Rose, who were 9 and 5 respectively when Scott went to Everest in 1996. Price earned her commercial pilot's license and became a captain for Alaska Airlines, a prestigious, well-paying career that allowed Fisher to climb full-time. Her income also permitted Fisher to launch Mountain Madness in 1984. If the name of Hall's business, Adventure Consultants, mirrored his methodical, fastidious approach to climbing, Mountain Madness was an even more accurate reflection of Scott's personal style. By his early 20s, he had developed a reputation for a harrowing, damn-the-torpedoes approach to ascent. Throughout his climbing career, but especially during those early years, he survived a number of frightening mishaps that, by all rights, should have killed him. On at least two occasions while rock climbing, once in Wyoming, another time in Yosemite, he crashed into the ground from more than 80 feet up. While working as a junior instructor on a Knowles course in the Wind River Range, he plunged 70 feet, unroped, to the bottom of a crevasse on the Dinwiddie Glacier. Perhaps his most infamous tumble, though, occurred when he was a novice ice climber. Despite his inexperience, Fisher had decided to attempt the coveted first ascent of a difficult frozen cascade called Bridal Veil Falls in Utah's Provo Canyon. Racing two expert climbers up the ice, Fisher lost his purchase 100 feet off the deck and plummeted to the ground. To the amazement of those who witnessed the incident, he picked himself up and walked away with relatively minor injuries. During his long plunge to earth, however, the tubular pick of an ice tool impaled his calf and came out the other side. When he extracted the hollow pick, it removed a core sample of tissue, leaving a hole in his leg big enough to stick a pencil through. Fisher saw no reason to waste his limited supply of cash on medical treatment for such a minor injury, so he climbed for the next 6 months with an open, suppurating wound. 15 years later, he proudly showed me the permanent scar inflicted by that fall, a pair of shiny, dime-sized marks bracketing his Achilles tendon. Scott would push himself beyond any physical limitation, recalls Don Peterson, a renowned American climber who met Fisher soon after his slip from Bridal Veil Falls. Peterson became something of a mentor to Fisher, and climbed with him intermittently over the next 2 decades. His will was astonishing. It didn't matter how much pain he was in, he would ignore it and keep going. He wasn't the kind of guy who would turn around because he had a sore foot. Scott had this burning ambition to be a great climber, to be one of the best in the world. I remember at the Knowles headquarters, there was a crude sort of gym. Scott would go into that room and regularly work out so hard that he threw up. Regularly. One doesn't meet many people with that kind of drive. People were drawn to Fisher's energy and generosity, his absence of guile, his almost childlike enthusiasm. Raw and emotional, disinclined toward introspection, he had the kind of gregarious, magnetic personality that instantly won him friends for life. Hundreds of individuals, including some he'd met just once or twice, considered him a bosom buddy. He was also strikingly handsome, with a bodybuilder's physique and the chiseled features of a movie star. Among those attracted to him were not a few members of the opposite sex, and he wasn't immune to the attention. A man of rampant appetites, Fisher smoked a lot of cannabis, although not while working, and drank more than was healthy. A back room at the Mountain Madness office functioned as a sort of secret clubhouse for Scott. After putting his kids to bed, he liked to retire there with his pals to pass around a pipe and look at slides of their brave deeds on the heights. During the 1980s, Fisher made a number of impressive ascents that earned him a modicum of local renown, but celebrity in the world-climbing community eluded him. Despite his concerted efforts, he was unable to land a lucrative commercial sponsorship of the sort enjoyed by some of his more famous peers. He worried that some of these top climbers didn't respect him. Recognition was important to Scott, says Jane Bromet, his publicist, confidant, and frequent climbing partner who accompanied the Mountain Madness expedition to base camp to file internet reports for Outside Online. He ached for it. He had a vulnerable side that most people didn't see. It really bothered him that he wasn't more widely respected as a butt-kicking climber. He felt slighted, and it hurt. By the time Fisher left for Nepal in the spring of 1996, he'd begun to garner more of the recognition that he thought was his due. Much of it came in the wake of his 1994 ascent of Everest, accomplished without supplemental oxygen. Christened the Sagarmatha Environmental Expedition, Fisher's team removed 5,000 pounds of trash from the mountain, which was very good for the landscape and turned out to be even better public relations. In January 1996, Fisher led a high-profile fundraising ascent of Kilimanjaro, the highest mountain in Africa, that netted $500,000 for the charity CARE. Thanks largely to the 1994 Everest cleanup expedition and this latter charity climb, by the time Fisher left for Everest in 1996, he had been featured prominently and often in the Seattle news media, and his climbing career was soaring. Journalists inevitably asked Fisher about the risks associated with the kind of climbing he did, and wondered how he reconciled it with being a husband and father. Fisher answered that he now took far fewer chances than he had during his reckless youth, that he had become a much more careful, more conservative climber. Shortly before leaving for Everest in 1996, he told Seattle writer Bruce Barcott, "I believe 100% I'm coming back. My wife believes 100% I'm coming back. She isn't concerned about me at all when I'm guiding, because I'm going to make all the right choices. When accidents happen, I think it's always human error, so that's what I want to eliminate. I've had lots of climbing accidents in my youth. You come up with lots of reasons, but ultimately it's human error." Fisher's assurances notwithstanding, his peripatetic alpine career was rough on his family. He was crazy about his kids, and when he was in Seattle, he was an unusually attentive father. But climbing regularly took him away from home for months at a time. He'd been absent for 7 of his son's 9 birthdays. In fact, say his friends, by the time he departed for Everest in 1996, Fisher's marriage had been seriously strained, a situation that was exacerbated by his financial dependence on his wife. Like most of its rivals, Mountain Madness was a fiscally marginal enterprise, and had been since its inception. In 1995, Fisher took home only about $12,000. But things were finally starting to look more promising, thanks to Fisher's growing celebrity and to the efforts of his business partner cum office manager, Karen Dickinson, whose organizational skills and level-headedness compensated for Fisher's seat-of-the-pants, what-me-worry modus operandi. Taking note of Rob Hall's success in guiding Everest and the large fees he was able to command as a consequence, Fisher decided it was time for him to enter the Everest market. If he could emulate Hall, it would quickly catapult Mountain Madness to profitability. The money itself didn't seem terribly important to Fisher. He cared little for material things, but he hungered for respect from his family, from his peers, from society at large, and he knew that in our culture, money is the principal gauge of success. A few weeks after Fisher returned victorious from Everest in 1994, I encountered him in Seattle. I didn't know him well, but we had some friends in common and often ran into each other at the crags or at climbers' parties. On this occasion, he buttonholed me to talk about the guided Everest expedition he was planning. "I should come along," he cajoled, "and write an article about the climb for Outside." When I replied that it would be crazy for someone with my limited high-altitude experience to attempt Everest, he said, "Hey, experience is overrated." "It's not the altitude that's important. It's your attitude, bro. You'll do fine. You've done some pretty sick climbs, stuff that's way harder than Everest. We've got the Big E figured out. We've got it totally wired. These days, I'm telling you, we've built a yellow brick road to the summit." Scott had piqued my interest, more even than he probably realized, and he was relentless. He talked up Everest every time he saw me, and repeatedly harangued Brad Wetzler, an editor at Outside, about the idea. By January 1996, thanks in no small part to Fisher's concerted lobbying, the magazine made a firm commitment to send me to Everest, probably, Wetzler indicated, as a member of Fisher's expedition. In Scott's mind, it was a done deal. A month before my scheduled departure, however, I got a call from Wetzler saying there'd been a change in plans. Rob Hall had offered the magazine a significantly better deal, so Wetzler proposed that I join the Adventure Consultants expedition instead of Fisher's. I knew and liked Fisher, and I didn't know much about Hall at that point, so I was initially reluctant. But after a trusted climbing buddy confirmed Hall's sterling reputation, I enthusiastically agreed to go to Everest with Adventure Consultants. One afternoon in base camp, I asked Hall why he'd been so eager to have me along. He candidly explained that it wasn't me he was actually interested in, or even the publicity he hoped my article would generate particularly. What was so enticing was the bounty of valuable advertising he would reap from the deal he struck with Outside. Hall told me that according to the terms of this arrangement, he'd agreed to accept only $10,000 of his usual fee in cash. The balance would be bartered for expensive ad space in the magazine, which targeted an upscale, adventurous, physically active audience, the core of his client base. "And most important," Hall said, "it's an American audience. Probably 80 or 90% of the potential market for guided expeditions to Everest and the other seven summits is in the United States. After this season, when my mate Scott has established himself as an Everest guide, he'll have a great advantage over Adventure Consultants simply because he's based in America. To compete with him, we'll have to step up our advertising there significantly." In January, when Fisher found out that Hall had won me away from his team, he was apoplectic. He called me from Colorado, as upset as I'd ever heard him, to insist that he wasn't about to concede victory to Hall. Like Hall, Fisher didn't bother trying to hide the fact that it wasn't me he was interested in, but rather the collateral publicity and advertising. In the end, however, he was unwilling to match Hall's offer to the magazine. When I arrived in base camp as a member of the Adventure Consultants Group, not Fisher's Mountain Madness expedition, Scott didn't appear to hold a grudge. When I went down to his camp to visit, he poured me a mug of coffee, put an arm around my shoulder, and seemed genuinely happy to see me. Despite the many trappings of civilization at base camp, there was no forgetting that we were more than 3 miles above sea level. Walking to the mess tent at mealtime left me wheezing for several minutes. If I sat up too quickly, My head reeled and vertigo set in. The deep, rasping cough I'd developed in Lobije worsened day by day. Sleep became elusive, a common symptom of minor altitude illness. Most nights, I'd wake up 3 or 4 times gasping for breath, feeling like I was suffocating. Cuts and scrapes refused to heal. My appetite vanished, and my digestive system, which required abundant oxygen to metabolize food, failed to make use of much of what I forced myself to eat. Instead, my body began consuming itself for sustenance. My arms and legs gradually began to wither to stick-like proportions. Some of my teammates fared even worse than I in the meager air and unhygienic environment. Andy, Mike, Caroline, Lou, Stuart, and John suffered attacks of gastrointestinal distress that kept them racing to the latrine. Helen and Doug were plagued by severe headaches. As Doug described it to me, "It feels like somebody's driven a nail between my eyes." This was Doug's second shot at Everest with Hall. The year before, Rob had forced him and 3 other clients to turn back just 330 feet below the top because the hour was late and the summit ridge was buried beneath a mantle of deep, unstable snow. "The summit looked so close," Doug recalled with a painful laugh. "Believe me, there hasn't been a day since that I haven't thought about it." He'd been talked into returning this year by Hall, who felt sorry that Hansen had been denied the summit and had significantly discounted Hansen's fee to entice him to give it another try. Among my fellow clients, Doug was the only one who'd climbed extensively without relying on a professional guide. Although he wasn't an elite mountaineer, his 15 years of experience made him fully capable of looking after himself on the heights. If anyone was going to reach the summit from our expedition, I assumed it would be Doug. He was strong, he was driven, and he had already been very high on Everest. Less than 2 months shy of his 47th birthday, divorced for 17 years, Doug confided to me that he'd been involved with a succession of women, each of whom eventually left him after growing tired of competing with the mountains for his attention. A few weeks before leaving for Everest in 1996, Doug had met another woman while visiting a friend in Tucson, and they'd fallen in love. For a while, they'd sent a flurry of faxes to each other. Then several days passed without Doug hearing from her. "Guess she got smart and blew me off," he sighed, looking despondent. "And she was really nice, too. I really thought this one might be a keeper." Later that afternoon, he approached my tent waving a fresh fax in his hand. "Karen Marie says she's moving to the Seattle area," he blurted ecstatically. "Whoa, this could be serious. I better make the summit and get Everest out of my system before she changes her mind." In addition to corresponding with the new woman in his life, Doug filled his hours at base camp by writing countless postcards to the students of Sunrise Elementary School, a public institution in Kent, Washington, that had sold T-shirts to help fund his climb. He showed me many of the cards. "Some people have big dreams, some people have small dreams," he penned to a girl named Vanessa. "Whatever you have, the important thing is that you never stop dreaming." Doug spent even more time writing faxes to his 2 grown kids, Angie, 19, and Jamie, 27, whom he'd raised as a single father. He bunked in the tent next to mine, and every time a fax would arrive from Angie, he'd read it to me, beaming. "Geez," he would announce, "how do you suppose a screw-up like me could have raised such a great kid?" For my part, I wrote few postcards or faxes to anybody. Instead, I spent most of my time in base camp brooding about how I'd perform higher on the mountain, especially in the so-called death zone above 25,000 feet. I'd logged considerably more time on technical rock and ice than most of the other clients and many of the guides, but technical expertise counted for next to nothing on Everest, and I'd spent less time at high altitude than virtually every other climber present. Indeed, here at base camp, the mere toe of Everest, I was already higher than I'd ever been in my life. This didn't seem to worry Hall. After 7 Everest expeditions, he explained, he'd fine-tuned a remarkably effective acclimatization plan that would enable us to adapt to the paucity of oxygen in the atmosphere. At base camp, there was approximately half as much oxygen as at sea level. At the summit, only a third as much. When confronted with an increase in altitude, the human body adjusts in manifold ways, from increasing respiration to changing the pH of the blood, to radically boosting the number of oxygen-carrying red blood cells, a conversion that takes weeks to complete. Hall insisted, however, that after just 3 trips above base camp, climbing 2,000 feet higher on the mountain each time, our bodies would adapt sufficiently to permit safe passage to the 29,028-foot summit. "It's worked 39 times so far, pal," Hall assured me with a crooked grin when I confessed my doubts. "And a few of the blokes who've summited with me were nearly as pathetic as you." Chapter 6. Everest Base Camp. April 12, 1996. 17,600 feet. The more improbable the situation, and the greater the demands made on the climber, the more sweetly the blood flows later in release from all that tension. The possibility of danger serves merely to sharpen his awareness and control. And perhaps this is the rationale of all risky sports. You deliberately raise the ante of effort and concentration in order, as it were, to clear your mind of trivialities. It's a small-scale model for living, but with a difference. Unlike your routine life, where mistakes can usually be recouped and some kind of compromise patched up, your actions, for however brief a period, are deadly serious. A. Alvarez, The Savage God, A Study of Suicide. Ascending Everest is a long, tedious process, more like a mammoth construction project than climbing as I'd previously known it. Counting our Sherpa staff, there were 26 people on Hall's team, and keeping everyone fed, sheltered, and in good health at 17,600 feet, 100 miles by foot from the nearest roadhead, was no mean feat. Hall, however, was a quartermaster nonpareil, and he relished the challenge. At base camp, he pored over reams of computer printouts detailing logistical minutiae, menus, spare parts, tools, medicines, communications hardware, load hauling schedules, yak availability. A natural-born engineer, Rob loved infrastructure, electronics, and gadgets of all kinds. He spent his spare time endlessly tinkering with the solar electrical system or reading back issues of Popular Science. In the tradition of George Lee Mallory and most other Everesters, Hall's strategy was to lay siege to the mountain. Sherpas would progressively establish a series of 4 camps above base camp, each approximately 2,000 feet higher than the last, by shuttling cumbersome loads of food, cooking fuel, and oxygen from encampment to encampment until the requisite materiel had been fully stocked at 26,000 feet on the South Col. If all went according to Hall's grand plan, our summit assault would be launched from this highest camp, Camp 4, a month hence. Even though we clients wouldn't be asked to share in the load hauling, we would need to make repeated forays above base camp before the summit push in order to acclimatize. Note: ever since the first Everest attempts, most expeditions, commercial and non-commercial alike, have relied on Sherpas to carry the majority of the loads on the mountain. But as clients on a guided trip, we carried no loads at all beyond a small amount of personal gear, and in this regard, we differed significantly from non-commercial expeditions of yore. End of note. Rob announced that the first of these acclimatization sorties would occur on April 13th, a one-day round trip to Camp 1, perched on the uppermost brow of the Khumbu Icefall, a vertical half-mile above. We spent the afternoon of April 12th, my 42nd birthday, preparing our climbing equipment. The camp resembled an expensive yard sale as we spread our gear among the boulders to sort clothing, adjust harnesses, rig safety tethers, and fit crampons to our boots. A crampon is a grid of 2-inch steel spikes that is clamped to the sole of each boot for purchase on ice. I was surprised and concerned to see Beck, Stewart, and Lou unpacking brand-new mountaineering boots that, by their own admission, had scarcely been worn. I wondered if they knew the chance they were taking by coming to Everest with untried footwear. 2 decades earlier, I'd gone on an expedition with new boots and had learned the hard way that heavy, rigid mountaineering boots can cause debilitating foot injuries before they've been broken in. Stewart, the young Canadian cardiologist, discovered that his crampons didn't even fit his new boots. Fortunately, After applying his extensive toolkit and considerable ingenuity to the problem, Rob managed to rivet together a special strap that made the crampons work. As I loaded my backpack for the morrow, I learned that between the demands of their families and their high-powered careers, few of my fellow clients had had the opportunity to go climbing more than once or twice in the previous year. Although everyone appeared to be in superb physical shape, circumstances had forced them to do the bulk of their training on stairmasters and treadmills rather than on actual peaks. This gave me pause. Physical conditioning is a crucial component of mountaineering, but there are many other equally important elements, none of which can be practiced in a gym. But maybe I'm just being a snob, I scolded myself. In any case, it was obvious that all of my teammates were as excited as I was about the prospect of kicking their crampons into a genuine mountain come the morning. Our route to the summit would follow the Khumbu Glacier up the lower half of the mountain. From the Bergschrund, at 23,000 feet, that marked its upper end, this great river of ice flowed 2.5 miles down a relatively gentle valley called the Western Khum. Note: a Bergschrund is a deep slit that delineates a glacier's upper terminus. It forms as the body of ice slides away from the steeper wall immediately above, leaving a gap between glacier and rock. End of note. As the glacier inched over humps and dips in the Khum's underlying strata, it fractured into countless vertical fissures, crevasses. Some of these crevasses were narrow enough to step across. Others were 80 feet wide, several hundred feet deep, and ran half a mile from end to end. The big ones were apt to be vexing obstacles to our ascent, and when hidden beneath a crust of snow, they would pose a serious hazard. But the challenges presented by the crevasses in the Khum had proven over the years to be predictable and manageable. The icefall was a different story. No part of the South Col route was feared more by climbers. At around 20,000 feet, where the glacier emerged from the lower end of the Khum, it pitched abruptly over a precipitous drop. This was the infamous Khumbu Icefall, the most technically demanding section on the entire route. The movement of the glacier in the icefall has been measured at between 3 and 4 feet a day. As it skids down the steep, irregular terrain in fits and starts, the mass of ice splinters into a jumble of huge, tottering blocks called seracs, some as large as office buildings. Because the climbing route wove under, around, and between hundreds of these unstable towers, each trip through the icefall was a little like playing a round of Russian roulette. Sooner or later, any given serac was going to fall over without warning, and you could only hope you weren't beneath it when it toppled. Since 1963, when a teammate of Hornbein and Unsold's named Jake Breitenbach was crushed by an avalanching serac to become the icefall's first victim, 18 other climbers had died here. The previous winter, as he had done in winters past, Hall had consulted with the leaders of all the expeditions planning to climb Everest in the spring, and together they'd agreed on one team among them who would be responsible for establishing and maintaining a route through the icefall. For its trouble, the designated team was to be paid $2,200 from each of the other expeditions on the mountain. In recent years, this cooperative approach had been met with wide, if not universal, acceptance, but it wasn't always so. The first time one expedition thought to charge another to travel through the ice was in 1988, when a lavishly funded American team announced that any expedition that intended to follow the route they'd engineered up the icefall would have to fork over $2,000. Some of the other teams on the mountain that year, failing to understand that Everest was no longer merely a mountain, but a commodity as well, were incensed. And the greatest hue and cry came from Rob Hall, who was leading a small, impecunious New Zealand team. Hall carped that the Americans were violating the spirit of the hills and practicing a shameful form of alpine extortion. But Jim Frush, the unsentimental attorney who was the leader of the American group, remained unmoved. Hall eventually agreed through clenched teeth to send Frush a check and was granted passage through the icefall. Frush later reported that Hall never made good on his IOU. Within 2 years, however, Hall did an about-face and came to see the logic of treating the icefall as a toll road. Indeed, from 1993 through 95, he volunteered to put in the route and collect the toll himself. In the spring of 1996, he elected not to assume responsibility for the ice fall, but he was happy to pay the leader of a rival commercial expedition, a Scottish Everest veteran named Mal Duff, to take over the job. Note: although I use commercial to denote any expedition organized as a money-making venture, not all commercial expeditions are guided. For instance, Mal Duff, who charged his clients considerably less than the $65,000 fee requested by Hall and Fisher, provided leadership and the essential infrastructure necessary to climb Everest, food, tents, bottled oxygen, fixed ropes, Sherpa support staff, and so on, but did not purport to act as a guide. The climbers on his team were assumed to be sufficiently skilled to get themselves safely up Everest and back down again. End of note. Long before we'd even arrived at base camp, a team of Sherpas employed by Duff had blazed a zigzag path through the seracs, stringing out more than a mile of rope and installing some 60 aluminum ladders over the broken surface of the glacier. The ladders belonged to an enterprising Sherpa from the village of Gorak Shep, who turned a nice profit by renting them out each season. So it came to pass that at 4:45 a.m. on Saturday, April 13th, I found myself at the foot of the fabled icefall, strapping on my crampons in the frigid pre-dawn gloom. Crusty old alpinists who've survived a lifetime of close scrapes like to counsel young protégés that staying alive hinges on listening carefully to one's inner voice. Tales abound of one or another climber who decided to remain in his or her sleeping bag after detecting some inauspicious vibe in the ether and thereby survived a catastrophe that wiped out others who failed to heed the portents. I didn't doubt the potential value of paying attention to subconscious cues. As I waited for Rob to lead the way, the ice underfoot emitted a series of loud cracking noises, like small trees being snapped in two, and I felt myself wince with each pop and rumble from the glacier's shifting depths. Problem was, my inner voice resembled Chicken Little. It was screaming that I was about to die, but it did that almost every time I laced up my climbing boots. I therefore did my damnedest to ignore my histrionic imagination and grimly followed Rob into the eerie blue labyrinth. Although I'd never been in an icefall as frightening as the Khumbu, I'd climbed many other icefalls. They typically have vertical or even overhanging passages that demand considerable expertise with ice axe and crampons. There was certainly no lack of steep ice in the Khumbu icefall, but all of it had been rigged with ladders or ropes or both, rendering the conventional tools and techniques of ice climbing largely superfluous. I soon learned that on Everest, not even the rope, the quintessential climber's accoutrement, was to be utilized in the time-honored manner. Ordinarily, one climber is tied to one or two partners with a 150-foot length of rope, making each person directly responsible for the life of the others. Roping up in this fashion is a serious and very intimate act. In the icefall, though, expediency dictated that each of us climb independently, without being physically connected to one another in any way. Mal Duff's Sherpas had anchored a static line of rope that extended from the bottom of the icefall to its top. Attached to my waist was a 3-foot-long safety tether with a carabiner, or snap link, at the distal end. Security was achieved not by roping myself to a teammate, but rather by clipping my safety tether to the fixed line and sliding it up the rope as I ascended. Climbing in this fashion, we would be able to move as quickly as possible through the most dangerous parts of the icefall, and we wouldn't have to entrust our lives to teammates whose skill and experience were unknown. As it turned out, not once during the entire expedition would I ever have reason to rope myself to another climber. If the icefall required few orthodox climbing techniques, it demanded a whole new repertoire of skills in their stead. For instance, the ability to tiptoe in mountaineering boots and crampons across 3 wobbly ladders lashed end to end, bridging a sphincter-clenching chasm. There were many such crossings, and I never got used to them. At one point, I was balanced on an unsteady ladder in the pre-dawn gloaming, stepping tenuously from one bent rung to the next, when the ice supporting the ladder on either end began to quiver as if an earthquake had struck. A moment later came an explosive roar as a large serac somewhere close above came crashing down. I froze, my heart in my throat, but the avalanching ice passed 50 yards to the left, out of sight, without doing any damage. After waiting a few minutes to regain my composure, I resumed my herky-jerky passage to the far side of the ladder. The glacier's continual and often violent state of flux added an element of uncertainty to every ladder crossing. As the glacier moved, crevasses would sometimes compress, buckling ladders like toothpicks. Other times a crevasse might expand, leaving a ladder dangling in the air, only tenuously supported, with neither end mounted on solid ice. Anchors securing the ladders and lines routinely melted out when the afternoon sun warmed the surrounding ice and snow. Despite daily maintenance, there was a very real danger that any given rope might pull loose under body weight. Note: 3-foot-long aluminum stakes called pickets were used to anchor ropes and ladders to snow slopes. When the terrain was hard glacial ice, ice screws were employed, hollow threaded tubes about 10 inches long that were twisted into the frozen glacier. End of note. But if the icefall was strenuous and terrifying, it had a surprising allure as well. As dawn washed the darkness from the sky, the shattered glacier was revealed to be a three-dimensional landscape of phantasmal beauty. The temperature was 6 degrees Fahrenheit. My crampons crunched reassuringly into the glacier's rind. Following the fixed line, I meandered through a vertical maze of crystalline blue stalagmites. Sheer rock buttresses seamed with ice pressed in from both edges of the glacier, rising like the shoulders of a malevolent god. Absorbed by my surroundings and the gravity of the labor, I lost myself in the unfettered pleasures of ascent, and for an hour or two actually forgot to be afraid. 3/4 of the way to Camp 1, Hall remarked at a rest stop that the icefall was in better shape than he'd ever seen it. "The route's a bloody freeway this season." But only slightly higher, at 19,000 feet, the ropes brought us to the base of a gargantuan, perilously balanced serac. As massive as a 12-story building, it loomed over our heads, leaning 30 degrees past vertical. The route followed a natural catwalk that angled sharply up the overhanging face. We would have to climb up and over the entire off-kilter tower to escape its threatening tonnage. Safety, I understood, hinged on speed. I huffed toward the relative security of the serac's crest with all the haste I could muster. But since I wasn't acclimatized, my fastest pace was no better than a crawl. Every 4 or 5 steps, I'd have to stop, lean against the rope, and sucked desperately at the thin, bitter air, searing my lungs in the process. I reached the top of the serac without it collapsing and flopped breathless onto its flat summit, my heart pounding like a jackhammer. A little later, around 8:30 a.m., I arrived at the top of the icefall itself, just beyond the last of the seracs. The safety of Camp 1 didn't supply much peace of mind, however. I couldn't stop thinking about the ominously tilted slab a short distance below, and the fact that I would have to pass beneath its faltering bulk at least 7 more times if I was going to make it to the summit of Everest. Climbers who snidely denigrate this as the Yak Route, I decided, had obviously never been through the Khumbu Icefall. Before leaving the tents, Rob had explained that we would turn around at 10 a.m. sharp, even if some of us hadn't reached Camp 1, in order to return to base camp before the midday sun made the icefall even more unstable. At the appointed hour, only Rob, Frank Fishbeck, John Taske, Doug Hansen, and I had arrived at Camp 1. Yasko Namba, Stuart Hutchison, Beck Weathers, and Lou Kosciuszko, escorted by guides Mike Groom and Andy Harris, were within 200 vertical feet of the camp when Rob got on the radio and turned everybody around. For the first time, we had seen one another actually climbing, and could better assess the strengths and weaknesses of the people on whom we would each depend over the coming weeks. Doug and John, at 56, the oldest person on the team, had both looked solid. But Frank, the gentlemanly soft-spoken publisher from Hong Kong, was the most impressive, demonstrating the savvy he'd acquired over 3 previous Everest expeditions. He'd started out slowly, but kept moving at the same steady pace. By the top of the icefall, he'd quietly passed almost everyone, and he never even seemed to be breathing hard. In marked contrast, Stuart, the youngest and seemingly strongest client on the whole team, had dashed out of camp at the front of the group, soon exhausted himself, and by the top of the icefall was in visible agony at the back of the line. Lou, hampered by a leg muscle he'd injured on the first morning of the trek to base camp, was slow but competent. Beck, and especially Yasko, on the other hand, had looked sketchy. Several times both Beck and Yasko had appeared to be in danger of falling off a ladder and plummeting into a crevasse, and Yasko seemed to know next to nothing about how to use crampons. Note: although Yasko had used crampons previously during her climbs of Aconcagua, McKinley, Elbrus, and Vinson, none of these ascents involved much, if any, true ice climbing. The terrain in each case consisted primarily of relatively gentle slopes of snow and or gravel-like scree. End of note. Andy, who revealed himself to be a gifted, extremely patient teacher, and who, as the junior guide, had been assigned to climb with the slowest clients at the rear, spent the whole morning coaching her on basic ice-climbing techniques. Whatever our group's various shortcomings, at the top of the icefall, Rob announced that he was quite pleased with everyone's performance. "For your first time above base camp, you've all done remarkably well," he proclaimed like a proud father. "I think we've got a good strong bunch this year." It took little more than an hour to descend back to base camp. By the time I removed my crampons to walk the last 100 yards to the tents, the sun felt like it was boring a hole through the crown of my skull. The full force of the headache struck a few minutes later, as I was chatting with Helen and Chongba in the mess tent. I'd never experienced anything like it. Crushing pain between my temples, pain so severe that it was accompanied by shuddering waves of nausea and made it impossible for me to speak in coherent sentences. Fearing that I'd suffered some sort of stroke, I staggered away in mid-conversation, retreated to my sleeping bag, and pulled my hat over my eyes. The headache had the blinding intensity of a migraine, and I had no idea what had caused it. I doubted that it was due to the altitude, because it didn't strike until I'd returned to base camp. More likely, it was a reaction to the fierce ultraviolet radiation that had burned my retinas and baked my brain. Whatever had brought it on, the agony was intense and unrelenting. For the next 5 hours I lay in my tent, trying to avoid sensory stimuli of any kind. If I opened my eyes or even just moved them from side to side behind closed eyelids, I received a withering jolt of pain. At sunset, unable to bear it any longer, I stumbled over to the medical tent to seek advice from Caroline, the expedition doctor. She gave me a strong analgesic and told me to drink some water, but after a few swallows I regurgitated the pills, the liquid, and the remnants of lunch. "Hmm," mused Caro, observing the vomitus splashed across my boots. "I guess we'll have to try something else." I was instructed to dissolve a tiny pill under my tongue, which would keep me from vomiting, and then swallow 2 codeine pills. An hour later, the pain began to fade. Nearly weeping with gratitude, I drifted into unconsciousness. I was dozing in my sleeping bag, watching the morning sun cast shadows across the walls of my tent, when Helen yelled, "John, telephone! It's Linda!" I yanked on a pair of sandals, sprinted the 50 yards to the communications tent, and grabbed the handset as I fought to catch my breath. The entire satellite phone and fax apparatus wasn't much larger than a laptop computer. Calls were expensive, about $5 a minute, and they didn't always go through, but the fact that my wife could dial a 13-digit number in Seattle and speak to me on Mount Everest astounded me. Although the call was a great comfort, the resignation in Linda's voice was unmistakable even from the far side of the globe. "I'm doing fine," she assured me, "but I wish you were here." 18 days earlier, she'd broken into tears when she'd taken me to the plane to Nepal. "Driving home from the airport," she confessed, "I couldn't stop crying. Saying goodbye to you was one of the saddest things I've ever done. I guess I knew on some level that you might not be coming back, and it seemed like such a waste. It seemed so fucking stupid and pointless." We'd been married for 15 and a half years. Within a week of first talking about taking the plunge, we'd visited a justice of the peace and done the deed. I was 26 at the time, and had recently decided to quit climbing and get serious about life. When I first met Linda, she had been a climber herself, and an exceptionally gifted one. But she'd given it up after breaking an arm, injuring her back, and subsequently making a cold appraisal of the inherent risks. Linda would never have considered asking me to abandon the sport, but the announcement that I intended to quit had reinforced her decision to marry me. I'd failed to appreciate the grip climbing had on my soul, however, or the purpose it lent to my otherwise rudderless life. I didn't anticipate the void that would loom in its absence. Within a year, I sneaked my rope out of storage and was back on the rock. By 1984, when I went to Switzerland to climb a notoriously dangerous alpine wall called the Eiger Nordwand, Linda and I had advanced to within millimeters of splitting up, and my climbing lay at the core of our troubles. Our relationship remained rocky for 2 or 3 years after my failed attempt on the Eiger, but the marriage somehow survived that rough patch. Linda came to accept my climbing. She saw that it was a crucial, if perplexing, part of who I was. Mountaineering, she understood, was an essential expression of some odd, immutable aspect of my personality that I could no sooner alter than change the color of my eyes. Then, in the midst of this delicate rapprochement, Outside Magazine confirmed it was sending me to Everest. At first I pretended that I'd be going as a journalist more than a climber, that I'd accepted the assignment because the commercialization of Everest was an interesting subject and the money was pretty good. I explained to Linda and anyone else who expressed skepticism about my Himalayan qualifications that I didn't expect to ascend very high on the mountain. "I'll probably climb only a little way above base camp," I insisted, "just to get a taste of what high altitude is about." This was bullshit, of course. Given the length of the trip and the time I'd have to spend training for it, I stood to make a lot more money staying home and taking other writing jobs. I accepted the assignment because I was in the grip of the Everest mystique. In truth, I wanted to climb the mountain as badly as I'd ever wanted anything in my life. From the moment I agreed to go to Nepal, my intention was to ascend every bit as high as my unexceptional legs and lungs would carry me. By the time Linda drove me to the airport, she had long since seen through my prevarications. She sensed the true dimensions of my desire, and it scared her. "If you get killed," she argued with a mix of despair and anger, "it's not just you who'll pay the price. I'll have to pay, too, you know, for the rest of my life. Doesn't that matter to you?" "I'm not going to get killed," I answered. "Don't be melodramatic." Chapter 7. Camp 1. April 13, 1996. 19,500 feet. But there are men for whom the unattainable has a special attraction. Usually they are not experts. Their ambitions and fantasies are strong enough to brush aside the doubts which more cautious men might have. Determination and faith are their strongest weapons. At best, such men are regarded as eccentric. At worst, mad. Everest has attracted its share of men like these. Their mountaineering experience varied from none at all to very slight. Certainly none of them had the kind of experience which would make an ascent of Everest a reasonable goal. Three things they all had in common: faith in themselves, great determination, and endurance. Walt Unsworth, Everest. I grew up with an ambition and determination without which I would have been a good deal happier. I thought a lot and developed the faraway look of a dreamer, for it was always the distant heights which fascinated me and drew me to them in spirit. I was not sure what could be accomplished by means of tenacity and little else, but the target was set high, and each rebuff only saw me more determined to see at least one major dream through to its fulfillment. Earl Denman, Alone to Everest. The slopes of Everest did not lack for dreamers in the spring of 1996. The credentials of many who'd come to climb the mountain were as thin as mine, or thinner. When it came time for each of us to assess our own abilities and weigh them against the formidable challenges of the world's highest mountain, it sometimes seemed as though half the population at base camp was clinically delusional. But perhaps this shouldn't have come as a surprise. Everest has always been a magnet for kooks, publicity seekers, hopeless romantics, and others with a shaky hold on reality. In March 1947, a poverty-stricken Canadian engineer named Earl Denman arrived in Darjeeling and announced his intention to climb Everest, despite the fact that he had little mountaineering experience and lacked official permission to enter Tibet. Somehow he managed to convince two Sherpas to accompany him, Ang Dawa and Tenzing Norgay. Tenzing, the same man who would later make the first ascent of Everest with Hillary, had immigrated to Darjeeling from Nepal in 1933 as a 17-year-old, hoping to be hired by an expedition departing for the peak that spring under the leadership of an eminent British mountaineer named Eric Shipton. The eager young Sherpa wasn't chosen that year, but he remained in India and was hired by Shipton for the 1935 British Everest expedition. By the time he agreed to go with Denman in 1947, Tenzing had already been on the Great Mountain three times. He later conceded that he knew all along Denman's plans were foolhardy, but Tenzing, too, was powerless to resist the pull of Everest. Nothing made sense about it. First, we would probably not even get into Tibet. Second, if we did get in, we would probably be caught, and, as his guides, we, as well as Denman, would be in serious trouble. Third, I did not for a moment believe that, even if we reached the mountain, a party such as this would be able to climb it. Fourth, the attempt would be highly dangerous. Fifth, Denman had the money neither to pay us well nor guarantee a decent sum to our dependents in case something happened to us. And so on and so on. Any man in his right mind would have said no. But I couldn't say no. For in my heart I needed to go, and the pull of Everest was stronger for me than any force on earth. Ang Dawa and I talked for a few minutes, and then we made our decision. Well, I told Denman, we will try. As the small expedition marched across Tibet toward Everest, the two Sherpas increasingly came to like and respect the Canadian. Despite his inexperience, they admired his courage and physical strength. And Denman, to his credit, was ultimately willing to acknowledge his shortcomings when they arrived on the slopes of the mountain, and reality stared him in the face. Pounded hard by a storm at 22,000 feet, Denman admitted defeat, and the three men turned around, returning safely to Darjeeling just 5 weeks after they'd departed. An idealistic, melancholic Englishman named Maurice Wilson had not been so fortunate when he'd attempted a similarly reckless ascent 13 years before Denman. Motivated by a misguided desire to help his fellow man, Wilson had concluded that climbing Everest would be the perfect way to publicize his belief that the myriad ills of humankind could be cured through a combination of fasting and faith in the powers of God. He hatched a scheme to fly a small airplane to Tibet, crash-landed on the flanks of Everest, and proceed to the summit from there. The fact that he knew absolutely nothing about either mountaineering or flying didn't strike him as a major impediment. Wilson bought a fabric-winged gypsy moth, christened it Everrest, and learned the rudiments of flying. He next spent 5 weeks tramping about the modest hills of Snowdonia and the English Lake District to learn what he thought he needed to know about climbing. And then, in May 1933, he took off in his tiny airplane and set a course for Everest by way of Cairo, Tehran, and India. By this time, Wilson had already received considerable coverage in the press. He flew to Purtabpore, India, but having not received permission from the Nepalese government to fly over Nepal, he sold the airplane for £500 and traveled overland to Darjeeling, where he learned that he had been denied permission to enter Tibet. This didn't faze him either. In March 1934, he hired three Sherpas, disguised himself as a Buddhist monk, and, defying the authorities of the Raj, surreptitiously trekked 300 miles through the forests of Sikkim and the sere Tibetan plateau. By April 14th, he was at the foot of Everest. Hiking up the rock-strewn ice of the East Rongbuk Glacier, he initially made fair progress, but as his ignorance of glacier travel caught up to him, he repeatedly lost his way and became frustrated and exhausted. Yet he refused to give up. By mid-May, he had reached the head of the East Rongbuk Glacier at 21,000 feet, where he plundered a supply of food and equipment cached by Eric Shipton's unsuccessful 1933 expedition. From there, Wilson started ascending the slopes leading up to the North Col, getting as high as 22,700 feet before a vertical ice cliff proved too much for him, and he was forced to retreat back to the site of Shipton's cache. And still he wouldn't quit. On May 28th, he wrote in his diary, "This will be a last effort, and I feel successful," and then headed up the mountain one more time. 1 year later, when Shipton returned to Everest, his expedition came across Wilson's frozen body, lying in the snow at the foot of the North Col. "After some discussion, we decided to bury him in a crevasse," wrote Charles Warren, one of the climbers who'd found the corpse. "We all raised our hats at the time, and I think that everyone was rather upset at the business. I thought I had grown immune to the sight of the dead, but somehow or other, in the circumstances, and because of the fact that he was, after all, doing much the same as ourselves, his tragedy seemed to have been brought a little too near home for us." The recent proliferation on the slopes of Everest of latter-day Wilsons and Denmans, marginally qualified dreamers like some of my cohorts, is a phenomenon that has provoked strong criticism. But the question of who belongs on Everest and who doesn't is more complicated than it might first appear. The fact that a climber has paid a large sum of money to join a guided expedition does not, by itself, mean that he or she is unfit to be on the mountain. Indeed, at least two of the commercial expeditions on Everest in the spring of 1996 included Himalayan veterans who would be considered qualified by the most rigorous standards. As I waited at Camp 1 on April 13th for my teammates to join me atop the icefall, a pair of climbers from Scott Fisher's Mountain Madness team strode past at an impressive clip. One was Clev Schoening, a 38-year-old Seattle construction contractor and a former member of the U.S. ski team who, although exceptionally strong, had little previous high-altitude experience. However, with him was his uncle Pete Schoening, a living Himalayan legend. Dressed in faded, threadbare Gore-Tex, a couple of months shy of his 69th birthday, Pete was a gangly, slightly stooped man who had returned to the high reaches of the Himalaya after a long absence. In 1958, he'd made history as the driving force behind the first ascent of Hidden Peak, a 26,470-foot mountain in the Karakoram Range of Pakistan, the highest first ascent ever achieved by American climbers. Pete was even more famous, however, for playing a heroic role in an unsuccessful expedition to K2 in 1953, the same year Hillary and Tenzing reached the peak of Everest. The eight-man expedition was pinned down in a ferocious blizzard high on K2, waiting to make an assault on the summit, when a team member named Art Gilkey developed thrombophlebitis, a life-threatening altitude-induced blood clot. Realizing that they would have to get Gilkey down immediately to have any hope of saving him, Schoening and the others started lowering him down the mountain's steep Abruzzi Ridge as the storm raged. At 25,000 feet, a climber named George Bell slipped and pulled four others off with him. Reflexively wrapping the rope around his shoulders and ice axe, Schoening somehow managed to single-handedly hold on to Gilkey and simultaneously arrest the slide of the five falling climbers without being pulled off the mountain himself. One of the more incredible feats in the annals of mountaineering, it was known forever after as simply the belay. Note: belay is a climbing term that denotes the act of securing a rope to safeguard one's companions as they climb. End of note. And now Pete Schoening was being led up Everest by Fisher and his two guides, Neil Beidelman and Anatoly Bukharev. When I asked Beidelman, a powerful climber from Colorado, how it felt to be guiding a client of Schoening's stature, he quickly corrected me with a self-deprecating laugh. "Somebody like me doesn't guide Pete Schoening anywhere. I just consider it a great honor to be on the same team as him." Schoening had signed on with Fisher's Mountain Madness group not because he needed a guide to lead him up the peak, but to avoid the mammoth hassle of arranging for a permit, oxygen, tentage, provisions, Sherpa support, and other logistical details. A few minutes after Pete and Clev Schoening climbed past en route to their own Camp 1, their teammate Charlotte Fox appeared. dynamic and statuesque, 38 years old, Fox was a ski patroller from Aspen, Colorado, who'd previously summited 2 8,000-meter peaks. Geshur-Brum II in Pakistan, at 26,000